I'm now called to order the required public meeting. The regular and supplemental meetings are all now called to order. And I'd like to recess the required public meeting and supplemental meeting. And the first thing I'd like to do is to have a moment of silence for all the people who are not with us anymore. Thank you. I guess I also would like to acknowledge all the veterans on Veterans Day, so all the people associated with the police and fire in any capacity who served our country. We just want to express gratitude and appreciation for all that you've done, all that you do, and all that means to what this country is about. So the first thing would be the consent agenda. And the approval of the minutes in the last meeting. People had a chance to review those, and are there any questions or comments? And I guess if not, can we have a motion to approve those minutes?
I'll so move.
Second?
Okay.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, that's approved. Next, we have the detailed consent agenda.
Are number 8 and 9 in the consent agenda and some new items? I don't remember seeing them before.
They are items that are infrequent on the agenda, but they're common. I mean, when they come up, we have them.
And what are they? What does 8 mean?
Is so that... 8 is if you, when you, at the time you leave DPFP and retire, your spouse at the time is your survivor. If you're not married or you get a divorce and you marry somebody else, you can add that new spouse on. There's a actuarial cost reduction for doing that and a waiting period to do that. So that's a SWAR. We also have a CAR, but you add a child after you retire. That's even less common and more expensive to do. And the approval of previously withdrawn contributions, that will happen if somebody is retired, they leave DPFP. I mean, they leave City of Dallas and they take a refund of their contributions and they get retired. They can pay those contributions back with interest to get their time back.
Okay, great. Thank you.
We have a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Move approval.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. So now we go to item D1, and this would be public comment.
This is the regular public comment that we do at the normal.
Okay. So does anyone out there in the public have any comments or would like to say something?
Star 5, the phone, then we can unmute them.
All right, thank you. So now we'll go to the discussion involving the staff retirement plan, and I'll turn that over to Kelly.
Great, thank you. Good morning, everybody. It's nice to see you all and more of you in person, which is really great. We have talked about the staff retirement plan. This is probably our sixth or so time, I guess. Talked about it last month. I did a little presentation about from my understanding, as well as some of the decisions that the board would need to make if you choose to participate in the plan. However, I am in no way an expert of the plan, so I brought in the people who are. So with us today, and I appreciate you coming up on your day off, from Austin, is two representatives from TMRS. We have Anthony Mills, who's the Director of City Services, and Leslie Carty, and she is the TMRS actuary. So Anthony is going to do an overview for you and talk to you about your choices and how TMRS works. And Leslie's here as a resource. And if you recall at the last meeting, there was quite a few questions about what makes the system's contribution rate go up and risks and those types of things. So I will turn it over to Anthony and Leslie, and then I'll talk to you a little bit more about some feedback I've gotten from the employees at the end of that. And
yeah, we want to clarify, this is only relating to the employees. This we're not talking about anything having to do with any of the participants or beneficiaries or anything like that.
Exactly. This is about the current and the future staff of DPSG who, at this time, have no lifetime stream of payments. They're not a Social Security. They're not in a defined benefit plan. This is a defined benefit plan. It's different than our defined benefit plan at DPSP at the time now, but it does provide a lifetime stream of payments. The staff in DPSP is probably just one of probably a handful of groups in the state of Texas that doesn't have something because we don't have Social Security and not in, in any form of stream of payments. So I think, especially working in a pension, it's the right thing to do. To provide that to employees,
that's my opinion. But it's also been a hindrance without it in attracting people to positions. That's correct?
I think so. I think we're not able to attract people, especially from the other 900 TMRS cities that are in the system. They would. I know specifically on the CFOA, or I'm the CFO, Chief Financial Officer, position, I was trying to recruit a person out of the city that's just a little bit north of us, and they didn't want to leave their TMRS plan.
Thank you very much, Kelly, and Mr. Chairman, members of the board. As Kelly pointed out, I'm Anthony Mills, Director of City Services at the Texas Municipal Retirement System. And I know I speak for our Board of Trustees and our Executive Director David Wesco and all the staff at TMRS when I say the consideration that you have in front of you, whether to join TMRS, if you do decide to join TMRS for DPFP, it would be our honor, our privilege to serve you. I'll give you a high-level overview of the TMRS retirement plan and allow you to ask any specific questions that you might have. As Kelly mentioned, I also have my colleague, Leslie Hardy, our Director of Actuarial Services, who's on hand, who could assist if you have any questions that's in her wheelhouse, and I'd just be happy to address any issues that you have. So let's talk about TMRS for just a moment. The Texas Municipal Retirement System, we've been operating since 1948, and in those nearly 75 years, over 900 cities, towns, and villages throughout the state of Texas have chosen TMRS as the retirement plan of choice. One of the items that I always do when I'm speaking with a governing body, because being good stewards, I know that you'd like to know. TMRS, we can distinguish ourselves in the public sector, and that's where we compare ourselves, but we could also distinguish ourselves even in the private sector if we were to look that way. Because TMRS has taken steps over the last decade or so to make sure that we stand out among the crowd. And one of the things I'd like to mention to you is that TMRS and our actuarial funding policy, our investment statement policy, and our approach with our diversified portfolio and total return strategy with a conservative return assumption makes TMRS really the model system for many of the public sector plans in Texas, and more so pension plans around the nation are starting to look at our cash balance design. You heard Kelly mention that TMRS, that we are cash balance, and by that what we mean is that TMRS, it would be the employees of the system who would pay into TMRS a percentage of their salary, and I believe for your consideration today, you're looking at either 6% or 7%. That money would come out of the paychecks, every paycheck, the gross compensation, 6 or 7% on a pre-tax basis. Those monies are deposited into the employee's personal account and will accrue interest annually. In that regard, we look more like a defined contribution plan in that it is going to be that primary cash balance that is going to have a lot to do with what the final retirement benefit will look like. But when we talk about the cash balance design of TMRS, it's not just the employee who is funding the retirement benefit. It would also be contributions coming from the employer. So the system would also be paying into far as matching the dollars that the employee has contributed to that personal account and the interest that's accrued on that account. So over the course of the career of the member, that account will grow, and when the member finally gets retirement, here's where our hybrid nature comes in. I said that we look like a defined contribution plan in the way that the dollars accrue in a cash balance. But unlike so many defined contribution plans, where when you get to the end of the career, you've got that cash balance and it's up to you to figure out how to make it last, in TMRS, we convert the cash balance to a lifetime stream of income, a lifetime stream of income. And one of the items that I would also point out to a governing body would be that the way that we calculate that retirement benefit by looking at a person's age when he retires to figure out how to divide that cash balance, that tells us all throughout that member's career, it's a predictable benefit all throughout the course of the career. And when I mention that, one of the items that I'd like to emphasize to you and illuminate is that our actuarial funding policy, saying that using the entry age normal methodology to fully fund a retirement benefit over the course of a member's career, we predict what that future benefit will look like, transparently present to you what those liabilities are, and then have you go about accruing the assets that you need to fully fund that benefit by the time the member gets to the end of his career. One of the other items that a governing body would need to know is that system-wide, we're looking at a 90% funded ratio. That 90% funded ratio, it doesn't tell you a whole lot if you don't know where we've been. A 90% funded ratio, if you had been 100%, may say, what's happening here? But when we look back more than a decade ago in TMRS, what you would find is that about a decade or so ago, we were near about 76% funded ratio. And that was after the point where we did a lot of heavy lifting to ensure that the cash balance design of our plan, the guarantee of that lifetime retirement benefit, that the need to make sure that we're being transparent with the liabilities that all of our cities and participating entities are building into their retirement plans, that those benefits need to be fully funded. We did the heavy lifting over the course of the last decade. Yes.
When you say you're 90% funded, is each entity responsible for their own plan, or we don't have a liability for other people's plans that may be underfunded, do we?
Very good question. Question being, when you're looking at the 901 different entities in TMRS, each one of them has its own financials. You've got your own assets, your own liabilities, your own funded ratio. The 90% funded ratio that I mentioned is our system-wide average. That is our system-wide average. We have more than 200-some-odd cities in TMRS that are more than 100% funded. And the beauty of our actuarial funding policy, as I've inferred, or you could infer from what I said earlier, is that all of the cities in TMRS, regardless of your funded ratio today, you're on track to trend toward 100% funded status. And the only way you're trending away from 100% funded status is if you're already overfunded. And again, we have more than 200-some-odd cities that are that. Good question. Thank you. The benefit itself, I mentioned to you that the member is going to contribute, if you choose to come into TMRS, pre-tax out of his paycheck, earn annual interest on his account. The body would continue to match the contributions that the member has in his account, grow that account over the course of a career, and then when he gets to the end of that career, we convert it to that lifetime retirement benefit. The member would get to retire if the member has at least 5 years of service and age 60, or 20 years of service and could retire at any age. I mentioned to you earlier that we use annuity purchase rates to determine how to calculate, how to divide the cash balance that the member has accrued. The way that the annuity purchase rate works, to oversimplify it just a bit, you could have two employees here at DPFP who start on the exact same day. One is 20 years old and the other is 40 years old. Just hypothetically, let's just say that these two employees who start have the same salary, and over the course of 20 years, the same salary adjustments. Now you're looking 20 years into the future, and now that 20-year-old is 40 years old, and the 40-year-old is 60 years old. Both of these members would be eligible to retire their accounts. Both of these members would have the exact same cash balance, but the calculated benefit will be different to members. If we were a pure defined benefit plan, you would use a formula that would probably take into account the number of years that the member had worked times a certain multiplier times a final average salary, and these two would get the exact same benefit. In a cash balance design like ours, they would not get the same benefit. I mentioned to you earlier that we would look at the person's life expectancy at retirement to determine what that annuity purchase rate is, to divide that pot of money so that it will last the course of that person's retirement life, so the rest of his lifetime. And that's where we get back to the predictable nature. From the time that a member starts to contribute into TMRS, projecting when that person would finally retire and start to draw benefit from TMRS, we could predict to you what you need to pay into TMRS. And the exhibits that have been presented to you by staff would show you for the different plan design options that you could choose from. And I believe that you're considering the 6% deposit rate for the employees, a 2-to-1 match, or 7% deposit rate for the employees and a 2-to-1 match. It would show you what we assume those liabilities would be. And the percentage of your overall covered payroll, that percentage that's included in those exhibits for the plan that is a 6% deposit, 2-to-1 match, the contribution rate would be 8.11%. For the 7% deposit, 2-to-1 match, a 9.44% contribution rate.
Now, why is that? Is that your investment assume rate greater than 5%? Is that part of that?
Why would the rates be different?
Yeah, why would it be 8 instead of 12 is what we've been putting in.
Gotcha. Because it's an actuarially determined contribution rate. What we're looking at the overall demographics of your plan. We're looking at each employee that could be enrolled in TMRS. We're looking at what point in the future would they retire the account. We're looking at what the benefit would actually be if you chose a 6% versus 7% benefit. So we know what those liabilities would look like, and to ensure that we're going to get the assets that you need to accrue the cash balance that the entity would need to have on account with TMRS, that's where we come up with that actuarially determined contribution rate.
What is your assumed investment rate then?
The assumed rate of return is 6.75%, one of the more conservative in Texas and even around the nation.
And to the extent that that exceeds the 5%, that's to the benefit of lowering contributions.
That is correct.
It doesn't get shared. The employees are set at 5%.
That is correct. That is correct. He's asking for clarification on the 6.75% assumed rate of return versus the guaranteed 5% that the members get. The city or the entity in this case shares in the upside, and the employee does not share in the downside on that.
Okay.
And that helps to keep those rates stable for the governing body. But these are the options that you're looking at. I mentioned to you that when the member gets to the end of the career and decides to retire his account, the member has the option to draw a lifetime retirement benefit just for himself or to leave a survivor benefit We would actuarially reduce the payment for the member if he's going to leave a survivor benefit. There are three different lifetime survivor options, whether a member could leave 100%, 75%, or 50% of his benefit to one joint survivor. And there are other options where the member could choose to leave a survivor benefit, but it's only guaranteed for a set period of time, 5, 10, or 15 years from the date that he retires. We would guarantee that if the member were to pass away during that time frame, we would continue to pay the retirement benefit that he was receiving to his beneficiary for the remainder of that term, and then the payments would stop. Should he outlive that guarantee term, we continue to pay him for the rest of his lifetime. And then there's also a lump sum payment option for the member when he retires. All of these payment options we look at and we have already predetermined over the course of the career. We consider all of the options that would be available, and all of that is factored into the rate that you would actually pay for the retirement benefit.
And to be clear, the lump sum is they can't. It's not. It's a partial lump sum. They're not allowed to take off of their entire cash balance. It's equal to that maximum 75% of their own account balance.
Yes, thank you, Leslie. That is especially here. That would be an important distinction to make. I believe having a defined contribution plan, it's very different than a benefit like ours that is guaranteeing a lifetime stream of income. When we say that a member retires from TMRS, we mean that they are going to retire and draw a lifetime monthly stream of income. And one of the additional payment options to go alongside that benefit would be to take that partial lump sum distribution at retirement. It's not a drop, which you may be more familiar with, a deferred retirement option plan. In TMRS, a member actually gets to retirement. We've already accrued the assets. We've already calculated in before that retirement date what the impact would be for the cost of that partial lump sum. Thank you for that lesson. And that really does walk you through the design of the cash balance system that TMRS has in place. We walk you through the options that would be available. I believe that your staff may recommend to you the difference between the actuarially determined employer contribution rate between the two plans. We've walked you through the different payment options that would be available for the member of DPFP when they finally retire. And with that, I'll open it up for any questions that you have for me.
Kelly, at this point, everybody would be prior service counts towards vesting.
Just for vesting, yes.
Would everybody be vested from DPFP, or do we have? No, I guess we don't. We have a few people who are less than 5 years.
Right, and I think it's maybe four or five people that wouldn't be vested.
Everybody else would be fully vested.
In TMRS, it would be 5 year vesting. So anyone who has less than 5 years of service would not yet be vested when they reach that 5 year mark, and that's a very good point to bring up. In your plan, because you did have a retirement plan in place before your hypothetical participation in TMRS, what we've done is we've given your members what we call excluded prior service credit. And that excluded prior service credit does give the time, it grants all the time that the employee has worked here leading up to participation in TMRS that would count toward those 5 years of vesting. But there is no monetary credit, so there's no liability to DPFP for the time that the member had prior to joining TMRS.
And then the 5% credit is also on the employer contribution or just the employee's contribution?
It's on the employee. The 5% guarantee is on the employee contribution, and it's annual.
What happens with the employer contribution? What is that credited with?
The employer contribution, we assume that we're going to credit it 6.75%, but as Board Member Quinn mentioned a moment ago and asked for clarification, the 6.75% assumption, I mentioned that you get to share on the upside of that. So in years that we outperform the 6.75, we do defer some of those gains to the governing body.
The last 2 years, we've been 20, so it's based on actual earnings. So the employers get, a board decides every March what the employer credit is going to be. And in their own accounts, like you said, you're responsible for the funding of your own plan, your own liabilities, your own benefit payments. We separately account for those for each individual city. Each has their own valuation, their own letter on contributions. The last 2 years, we in 2019, we credited 15.4 to the employers, and in 2020, we credited 7.5. Our assumption is 6.75, so we have outperformed the last 2 years. We are, unless things go down this, you know, the rest of the year, I don't like to jinx things, but we are on schedule to also do that. We smooth our assets. We do not reflect gains or losses all in 1 year, because we don't want your contribution rates going up and down with the volatility of the markets. We smooth our assets over a 10-year period, and that has worked very well for us. And we offset those. So in a year, if you have a loss, the next year we've had a gain, then it brings us back to zero. And there's been some our actuarial value of assets and market value of assets have been very close together.
I'm still a little confused. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just a little confused. Say that 6.7 is exactly what we earn every year, and we get credited at that. Does the employee benefit from that, or is that just the reduction? That's strictly a reduction of our costs. But they get our 12%.
They get your matching. So if it's 2 times 6, yeah, it's 12, and it's 2 times 7, 14.
Okay,
that is
so
correct, and they get a lot
added to their account for calculating the annuity.
When they retire.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, you've already said this, I apologize, so because it's a pension plan, not to jinx it, but let's say you don't get that rate of return. Do we have an additional liability?
No. Well, so you don't have any assets in here. So if we didn't earn that, but you're correct, if we didn't earn that, then it would be offset with any gains first. So, for instance, this year, if we ended up not doing our 675, we would take the deferred gains we have, because, like I said, we don't recognize all of the gains and we don't recognize all the losses. So, but you are correct that it's possible that if the assets didn't track with your accrued liabilities, then that there would be a gap. You would have an unfunded liability that we would amortize. Every year we look at what we expect the unfunded to be versus what it actually is. And as you know, it could be because accrued liabilities were higher, our assets were lower, and it can go the other direction as well. And we amortize those losses for each individual city or employer over a 20-year period. That is closed. What I recommend many times for entities like yourself that are coming in is that your contribution rate will fluctuate. We're going to calculate it every year, okay? And what we estimate what we think is going to be. The normal cost is the value of the benefits that we expect to be accruing during the year after you come in, okay? It's never going to be exactly right, okay? But if you're if it ends up where your assets are not exactly equal to the accrued liabilities, then you would have an unfunded liability. You're in the unique position to do something that I recommend you consider, which would be to contribute at a rate higher than.
Okay, I keep dropping.
I just dropped. I just dropped as well.
I just dropped as well. Someone needs to say something to. Can someone say something to, like the email or something? Maybe John.
Yeah.
I'll send John an email.
Okay.
So we need to dial back. Is that?
They're reaching
out
there.
No, because I think that because we're collectively together, that it's just really on their side, not our side.
Yeah. Okay. I just sent Kelly a
message. I sent one to John.
She responded with okay. So then they're aware of it.
Okay, great. Thank you, guys. right at the nitty gritty too, like where I wanted to hear, like, I recommend that you, and then Rudy froze it. I'm like, well.
Yeah, I think it was right at the unfunded liability question.
Right. She was just saying, like, well, you're in a unique position because if I was you, you could. The other issue, too, is if we're all dropped, isn't there, like, a quorum issue?
Tina, we stopped when we knew that you were off, but can everybody hear us on the audio?
Yes.
Yes, we can hear you.
Yeah, we can.
We stopped at the position where I think Leslie was talking about you, that you are at a unique position. That's where I think we got cut off.
Okay, so what I was saying is that you're in the unique position where you're coming in with no accrued liabilities, no assets, so you have no unfunded. So in order to add some cushion is that and to know what your rate is, I suggest this to a lot of cities, and we have a lot of cities that do this. They determine a rate above the required rate that they contribute every month. Now, if things got tough for some reason, then you only have to contribute. You could change it at any time. You're not obligated to continue to contribute at 11%. You could go back to the 944 or whatever the minimum is. But you have to make that at least every month. And you can't say, well, we did 11% for a few months, so now we're only going to contribute 8 for these next few months. You have to always make at least, no matter what, the minimum every month. However, what you would be doing it does two things. It stabilizes your rate. If you could find it in your budget to just contribute at something above the required rate, it does two things. It stabilizes your rate, and it makes certain that your assets are greater than your liabilities, and it affords you a cushion if we did have future adverse experience, either on your accrued liability or your assets, or both. There are other benefits that, depending on later, if you wanted to increase benefits at a later point in time, then you would have more assets that would make that impact of a change in benefits. If there ever was a decision made to increase benefits, then you would have assets that would make that impact less.
I think that maybe some people are thinking, and I'm kind of thinking this too, is that it seems like there's all sorts of safeguards and sort of bumpers to kind of help put anything kind of back on track and to smooth out volatility and all those sorts of things. But I think people would like to know, ultimately, if there's an unfunded gap, whose responsibility is that? What variable gets pushed? Is it the ultimate benefit? Is it that the plan is ultimately responsible? Who's the ultimate liability accrued to?
Well, it's to the employer, so it would be to you. So if there becomes an unfunded liability, if you become unfunded, then your required rate will have a normal cost rate, and then it will have what we call a prior service rate that requires you to fully fund that gap over a 20-year period.
Okay.
So and our amortization periods are closed. Our amortization period over the last, since in the last 10 years has gone, or 14 years from 2007, has gone from 29.4. We started at 30. Now we only have 20-year amortization periods. So, and we're down, you know, to 16. So the amortization periods go down every year, and they are closed. So we will, to answer your question, if contributions will rise if investments, you know the basic funding formula, contributions plus investment earnings equal benefit payments. Well, if you can't afford your contributions, then you know you can reduce benefits. And TMRS, you can reduce benefits.
Yes, that is something that you should also know. This board or future boards would have at their disposal tools to adjust the cost of the plan. You do have the option to look at the match that you have in place. Now, the employee contribution rate, that would require if you were ever to consider lowering the employee contribution rate, you would have to get two-thirds of the employees to agree to reduce that percentage. Say you had gone in at 7% and at some point the unforeseen were to happen, and that's one of the tools in your toolkit that you'd like to consider. You would have to get a two-thirds vote of the workforce to reduce it from 7 to 6. But the matching ratio, that would be at the governing bodies.
The employee contribution gets added to the employee's contribution plus 5%.
Right.
That's correct.
So
yes.
If we opted for 9% instead of 12, does that mean there's a less of a benefit for the employees?
No.
Theirs is calculated based on the 12?
Theirs is calculated if you pick 6 and a 2%, times match, it's double that. It's
okay.
The contribution rate is really just going to determine
and
how well funded the plan is. One thing I just want to mention, because we do have employees listening as well, if the employees did decide on a two-thirds vote to lower the employee contribution amount, that's prospective. So if it was 7% for 10 years of their career, it's going to be their benefit be calculated based on that.
That is correct. Any
taken away.
That's correct. Any benefits that have already been accrued under the current plan design before that plan change, those benefits are already in place and will continue to be funded at that rate, and then prospectively the change would take effect.
Okay, so back to that question of ultimately it's our responsibility. The answer to that is yes, but you have the ability going forward to reduce benefits in order to reduce that liability. Is that correct? Okay. Right.
And I will say that you know, one of our strategic goals and part of our funding policy is contribution rate stability, which is one of the reasons we have a 10-year smoothing with a 20-year amortization. So that's a combined 30 years. It's worked very well. We did lots of modeling, but the 10-year smoothing definitely dampens the contribution rate volatility. And the way that we look at offset our gains and losses, if we have gains, then the first thing we do, any loss, so it's really dampened the volatility associated with any kind of asset risk. Our contribution rates have been, over the last decade, have had less than 25 basis points of volatility system-wide. Obviously, it varies by city, but, in most of our plans, I think they might have provided you a chart, most of our plans have covered 92% of the participants at a 7% 2-to-1 with our famous updated service credit, which I know Kelly had mentioned is our most complicated, and then also, post-retirement COLAs. So they're a little bit of a bigger benefit plan than what you're looking at, but their rates have been pretty stable over the last 13 years right at 13%.
Yeah, I mean, the stability here and the time-tested nature of what y'all are offering is very, very appealing. We just happen to come from a background where we have some scar tissue and where's the volatility, because that's the world that we've known, for the last several years. So we can't help but sort of think of that.
I understand. Well, we won't let it run away from you. We will make you,
Kelly, do you want to sort of talk a little bit about, your recommendation? And, we've talked about this, a lot. We're very pleased you guys would come up. I think that just adds to the mosaic of credibility and just something you can count on, dependability. So, Kelly, tell us, as the leader of the organization, where you're coming from and what you recommend.
Okay. So.
And by the way, any other questions? Also, I don't mean to cut anyone off.
I have a question. far as expenses go, so how much do you guys charge for administrating the plan? And then is there any kind of charges for managing assets? And then if there are charges on either side, is that paid by the employer or the employees or a mixture?
All of our investment returns before we credit the interest are net of expenses. Our administrative expenses are about 7 basis points out of $37 billion. So we pay, our statute requires that we look at all of our investment return for the year, and then we pay our administrative expenses, our salaries, and the investment return is always net of expenses. So in other words, before we credit, our 675 is after all of that. So there's no direct cost to you. It's out of our investment return, and the 675 assumption is a net return. So all of our returns that you've seen are after expenses are paid for, you know, managing the assets. You know, we have tons of managers. You can. That's all reflected in our annual report. But there's nothing direct to the system.
Can I also mention, Kelly, there is an additional benefit that comes should you choose to join TMRS, and that is the supplemental death benefit. In addition to the retirement that we've spoken to you about today, there is a benefit that works like an insurance benefit, life insurance benefit, that would be over and above any retirement benefit, where an active employee of DPFP, if they were to pass away, we would pay 1x the annual salary to his beneficiary. That's over and above any retirement benefit that they may be entitled to. And then once they've actually retired from the system, and pass away as a TMRS retiree, it's no longer tied to salary. It's now a one-time $7,500 lump sum death benefit. And the cost for that, regardless of the two plans I think that you're considering, is the same rate, 0.13% of the total rate.
So my recommendation is, so I work for a pension, obviously. I believe in pensions. I think it's important. I think it is incredibly ironic that the people that work at this pension system that dedicate their lives to these employees and have, you know, and it's not the easiest plan in the world, believe me, and we all know that, that they themselves don't have a lifetime stream of payments. That just in the core of me feels wrong. However, that being said, I did do a little survey of the employees, and I asked them a few questions, literally 4 questions. And one of the questions was, would you prefer the 6% or the 7%? Everybody but one person voted for the 7%. I asked the question, are you opposed to the change, or do you support the change, or are you neutral? 1/3 of the employees were actually opposed to the change to TMRS. 2/3 were in favor of it. The third question was, will that change, if we go to TMRS, will that positively or negatively impact your desire to stay with DPFP, acknowledging people stay and go for a variety of reasons. 5 of the people that were opposed said it would impact their feelings about staying with DPFP. So, you know, that's where the employees are. I can't and won't say what's in the best interest of individual employees. I do think, and maybe because I'm older, that having a lifetime stream of payments is very, very important. And I do think that every study out there has shown that defined contribution plans are less effective for retirement than cash balance plans or defined benefit plans. The annuity options are so much better than you can buy in the market. I believe it is better for the employees, but employees obviously have made their own thoughts about that with their knowledge and their own individual situations, talking to their coworkers, that type of thing. But I would recommend that we move to TMRS. I think it's the right thing for the plan. I think it's the right thing for current employees, in my opinion only, and future employees. I would recommend the 7% and the 2% match. That costs the system less money than we're currently paying. I would also recommend what Leslie mentioned, that we're used to paying 12%. I would continue, if the board wanted to do that, continue to pay the 12%. That pre-funds any potential liability, gets rid of the swings. Also would pre-fund an updated service credit if you want to do that in the future, and about 90% of the employees currently have the updated service credit. The supplemental death benefit is great as well. So I guess that's my recommendation. Thank you for allowing me to provide that.
We've studied this issue, a fair amount. No process is perfect, but I feel like, it's a time, to act. So I'm fully behind what Kelly is saying. And so would someone like to make a motion? I guess the motion would be to adopt this TMRS plan and authorize the staff to take the actions for people to become members, to terminate the existing plan, and to follow Kelly's suggestion of the 7% and 2X match with funding at the 12%, which is what we have done in prior years. So would someone make motion?
The old plan, we are terminating it prospectively, but it'll still be there for whatever balances are in there, right?
Correct. So the 457 plan is going to stay there. We've been working with Ice Miller and Voya on how best to terminate that plan, and we may have to, if employees want to take their money out of Voya and roll it somewhere else, we're going to have to terminate the plan, but we would give people plenty of time to do that. We can also freeze the plan, but then people can't take the money out. We're looking at
Kelly, this is Michael Brown. Before we take a vote, I just had a question. Were you surprised by the employee responses in terms of your questions, the one-third, two-thirds, or some of the answer to leave if impact? Did that surprise you? Or
it did, Michael. It did surprise me, and I really think there was some lobbying going on. I think people are in individual situations. And I also feel like, some people haven't lived through 2008, or if they have, they were really young and they've learned about 2008, but it wasn't their money, right? Wasn't their money. A very different feeling when it's your money. So it's complicated understanding how the annuity factors would work. This is just a really complicated thing. But yes, I was surprised. I thought there would be three people opposed just based on individual conversations I've had, but I can tell you there has to be people that voted opposed that have not reached out to me with a question and have not reached out to Josh or to TMRS with a question. So there was the fourth question I had was kind of some open-ended comments, and the comments were we can do better in the market ourselves, the employer can we can lose the employer contribution in many ways. And I do believe it's a real concern that if you're not vested, you would lose your employer contribution. I think that's a valid concern. Other people were concerned about having to pay for a survivor benefit where in your DC plan you have that. Well, not really, because you'd have to save the money for your survivor anyway. So just I think there's a lot of confusion, and people feel like the stock market's been really good for a while and they can beat 5%. That's my opinion, but long way to say yes, I was surprised. That's the number.
I had a lot of experience with DC plans and lump sums with our pilots at American Airlines, and that leads to a lot of problems. I think having the certainty of an annuity is best interest of our employees, plus we can attract other employees. So I would move approval as you cite.
Okay, so you'd like to make the motion?
I'll make the motion.
I'll second.
So we have a second. Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
I'm opposed.
Okay. So we have
nine and one.
Ten and one.
Nine and one. We only have ten.
Yeah, absentee.
Okay. All right. The motion carries. So now we're going to go.
Thank you very much, Chairman.
Thank you indeed. And the commitment that you have from TMRS. And to your members who may be listening on the phone, TMRS, we are committed to superior service. And any questions that you have as a governing body as you move forward, don't hesitate calling us. For the members who may have questions, I think they've already had contact with TMRS and will continue to have that contact, and we're dedicated to delivering that superior service. Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
I guess I'd like to make one comment. Just remembering the first time, Kelly, you broached this issue, we've worked through a lot of this. So I think this is a good example of, you know, everyone had kind of a first instinct relative to our existing state with our plan, and there was good communication. There was an opportunity for people to air issues. There was good debate, good information, and now it's leading to a resolution. So I think it's a good case study, and us working through a process probably touched on 4 or 5 different meetings.
Right.
Yeah. And so I just think that working through processes is such an important part of us getting this into a good place, and I think this is a good example of where we work through it, and versus the gut reaction when you first said it is, you know, we have this plan, we have, you know, and it was sort of a context in which everyone evaluated it, and now we got to a good resolution. So that's great.
Now, does this take effect immediately, December 1 they can get in, or is this calendar year, January 1?
We would shoot for January 1st.
So January 1
is the plan.
Okay. So now we're going to segue to something very, very simple. actuarial training.
Oh, hey.
Oh, Leslie should be here.
No pressure, Jeff.
Thank you. First of all, who can spell the word actuarial?
We have a lot of actuaries. Like a job. Check, looks you in the eye.
So while they're getting set up, I'll just say that the board had asked for some actuarial training, and we'll also be able to get PRB, half-hour PRB credit for this. So what I've asked Jeff and Caitlin to do, and you all remember Jeff and Caitlin, I'm sure, is to not give us really actuarial 101, but to knowing our plan and our specific issues, to try to really focus on issues that are meaningful to us, and I think they did a good job with what I've looked at in the presentation. So that's what we're doing here today. And we thought we would do this then before we go over the actuarial report because it's timely.
All right. What page is this on?
It's not in there.
It is in. It should be in.
Is it?
Is it under the required public meeting?
Thank you.
Or no, it's under the regular meeting.
Of the 117, what?
Required public.
No, this is still part of the regular meeting.
Still part of the regular meeting? Okay.
Melissa, where is this in Diligent? It's on page 3. It's on page 3 of the... Yes. Oh, no, that's... I'm sorry, that's actuarial.
117 on Diligent?
Yeah, so we're bouncing around this meeting, as you will see.
It should be the same in the PDF as well.
Okay, page 117.
No, it's not 117.
Page 3.
That's the valuation report. This is the training report.
But it's on the PDF?
Yeah. Are you on the second version?
Just on Diligent.
You're in Diligent?
Yeah.
Okay, 117.
He's on 117.
That's not 117.
I'm opening my door.
If it's on the PDF, I'll go to that.
I'm not sure where it is on the PDF either.
It's on 117 on the PDF, on the second PDF that Melissa sent out yesterday. Did you update your? Did you sync your updates?
Yeah, I was about to say it looks like you didn't get an update because it was grayed out. Go to the PDF. Maybe.
Yeah, it's in my.
Okay.
Go to the PDF.
And it's 117. Sure, and both. Yeah.
Okay, so the 404 page is 117.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's 117 of 404.
Got it.
Thank you. back here, first of all. It's good to put in meetings from my basement, but get out every once in a while. You know, I'm sure everybody remembers Caitlin Bryce as well. Caitlin's been here several times. She'll continue to, I'm sure, come to most of the meetings with me. So, you know, Kelly asked us to put together something, like she said, not an actuarial 101, but just, you know, a few things to consider. There's a couple things. There's a lot of information in these reports. You know, we give you, what, 60, 70-page reports. And really the idea is what do you actually care about that's in the report. There's a lot of stuff in there that's good information. It provides a picture of how we got to where we are, a lot of background information, but not all that we focus on. You know, when we do the report presentations, we go through a summary or just a few pages in the beginning. We don't go through every page in the report. It's not needed. This portrait, actually, we include a lot of times in presentations and never talk about it. And, you know, every actuarial firm has this or a similar picture they put out there. I'm on page 3 of our presentation, 119. But this is actually a good, you know, a good picture, a good, this is evaluation right here. You know, we take the assumptions and provisions and the data. We run that through our software. We come up with a present value benefit, and a benefit stream that's expected to be paid in the future. You know, there's many different actuarial, a handful of different actuarial cost methods. You guys are using what's called the entry age normal method, which is the most popular method. About 60%, two-thirds of public funds use this funding method. And funding methods, they allocate how you're going to look at your normal costs and your accrued liability. They allocate a timing. I'm not going to go through this whole picture, but this is evaluation in a snapshot of one frame right here, what goes into evaluation. So, as I mentioned, there's a lot of information in the reports. You know, we've got current and historical demographic data, current historical financial, there's reconciliations of demographics and financials, actuarial value of assets, actuarial determined contribution. You know, there's a lot of stuff in the report. Like I said, most of it is built up to past, how we get to where we are now. But do we care about all this stuff? No. As trustees, no, you don't. There really is a few things that we focus on most. This is our opinion. You know, there's other things we could have included on here, but this is, in our opinion, the most important things really that you should kind of be aware of when you're looking at an evaluation report. That is the assumptions, the normal cost, and this is not board importance. This is just kind of how I came up with assumptions, normal cost, asset smoothing, funded percentage, the payroll, and the impact on your fund, the actual determined contribution, and then a couple of extra items at the end, plan changes, you know, can they help you, and, you know, what will get you where you want to be. So the assumptions... The assumptions and evaluations, they determine the current cost of the plan, not the ultimate cost. You know, the ultimate cost of a plan is benefits paid plus the expenses. And that's ultimately what the cost of the plan is. And assumptions will change over time. And, you know, we look at the assumptions every 5 years. Sometimes, you know, we lower the discount rate this year from 7 to 6.5. We'll look at it in interim in between the experience studies. But the assumptions do impact the liability, the normal cost, but the assumptions do not determine the plan cost. They determine the timing of the cost. And really, with the assumptions, we're trying to get a good feel for what's going to happen when. We try to match the expected demographic outcomes, basically financial outcomes. We're trying to predict when people are going to retire, when they're going to die, quit, things of that nature. And that's part of that is looking at historical information, what's happened in the past. Part of it is what we expect to happen in the future, trends with the fund. But if we get the assumptions, the more accurate the assumptions are, it's a better sense of when and how much the benefits will be paid. And that's the whole point of trying to get your assumptions in sync is, okay, you know, if your retirement assumption, you're assuming people retire way out in the future versus they're retiring earlier, that doesn't do you any good because you need that, you know, it does impact the cost, and you need to know if you need to put more money in sooner. Now, you're in a little bit different situation. We'll talk about that because, you know, with assumptions really are the actual determined contribution. I mean, you're trying to get that as accurate as possible when you're paying each year. You guys aren't paying the actual determined contribution. You have statutory rates, so it's a little bit different, but you still want to get your assumptions as accurate as you can, because you want to predict a benefit payment stream. That's really what you're trying to do here. Your payment stream is very important. I mean, they are for every plan. You guys have some unique circumstances that we don't often see. So we're trying to get the assumptions right. Ultimately, kind of like a third pull it up from the bottom. If for any plan to work over the long term, you need that equation to balance out. The contributions plus the investment income is equal to benefit payments plus the expenses. So right now, not everything is where we want it to be, but we're trying to set the assumptions as accurately as we can. We think it's a positive move, lowering your discount rate to 6.5%. There's no sense in having assumptions that you don't believe in. We don't think 7% is going to hold true over time based on your current your market allocations and where the outlook is for the market. You lower. And in your situation, we'll talk about it. But like I said, you're not contributing to determine contributions. So it's kind of an interesting situation. The normal cost of the plan. This is the portion of the present value of the benefits that's allocated to the current year. Different funding methods do this differently, as I mentioned. You're using the interregional method. And the fourth bullet down, I'm just going to read through it. It's calculated under the interregional method. Normal cost is calculated on an individual basis based on the plan of benefits applicable to that member. There are different ways of doing interregional costs. This is the most prevalent one we prefer, one I prefer, at least. There's some plans use what's called a ultimate entry age or replacement life, where they're calculating based on the benefits for the most current hires, current members. So if you did that, it'd be different because you have different tiers of benefits for different members. But this is calculating the cost for each individual member based on their benefit. That's the percentage of pay that is contributed annually from entry age to retirement for the active members would fund the members' projected benefits at retirement. Now, if you're a union plan, or I say union, I don't mean like police and fire union, I mean like a building trades union plan, Taft-Hartley plan, it would usually be, instead of a percentage of pay, it would be a dollar amount, because those plans are usually dollar amount based, they're not a percentage of pay. But for you, it's the percentage of pay. And for the most part, the normal cost is going to be relatively stable over time, barring any assumption or plan changes. See down there the 2020 normal cost. This is the total normal cost before you look at employee contribution. Total normal cost was 15.3%. Prior to any assumption changes this year, it was 15.36%. Well, after the assumption changes, that went up 17.29. Like I said, the assumptions do impact the cost, or they impact the normal cost and liability. Over time, though, it should decrease a little bit as the newer hires become more. A larger portion of your active population. The normal cost for the pre-March 1, 2011 member or hires is greater than the current normal cost because they have a larger benefit.
So just to clarify, normal cost, let's say someone makes $50,000 a year.
Okay.
So that would be that of the $50,000, if we have 17.29, that's about $8,500 of that salary is needed to fund the benefit for that year. Is that what that means?
Essentially, yes.
Yeah. And it is the even though the benefit won't be paid till later years, it's the present value of the benefit that will have been earned that year, right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
The funding method, it slices between the normal cost and the actuarial liability. And, we're looking to get the present value of future normal cost, and then we bring it back for the current year.
And then that assumes that amount, that $8,500 in the case of the $50,000 person at 17%, that earning 6.75% over time would then fully fund the benefit that wouldn't kick in until some period later, and then
right.
be over an extended period of time beyond that.
Right.
Okay.
That percentage applies to the person's pay over time.
Yeah.
Each year would
would account for that. And now that's the total normal cost. You know, the portion, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but the actuarial determined contribution is the employer normal cost plus the payment on the unfunded liability. Now, the employer's normal cost, you have the total normal cost, you add in the administrative expense assumption, but then you subtract out the employee contributions. So the employees are paying 13.5%. So that's a pretty big contribution percentage. And, you know, like I said, the normal cost, 17.29, this plan is still good benefits. I know they've changed over time, but in my opinion, at least, it's still pretty strong benefits. You know, I've got plans where the normal cost is, you know, 20-30%. It depends on the plan of benefits and when people retire, and it's all dependent on that organization and that system. So
Jeff, what you just said is where I get confused. So
surprised it took me this long to confuse somebody. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
I got confused people earlier than this, but
I just didn't admit it. But so I get confused between the normal cost and the benefit, because I understand with what you were saying and with Nick's question that the cost of providing the benefit is a 17.29, and the reason that it went up when we lower the assumed rate of return is because now we're assuming we're going to earn less on our investments, so now the employer has to pay more. That's on the cost side. But you were just talking about the value of their benefit, which is a difference.
Well,
because their benefit is not increasing because I lowered my
assumed
rate of return.
Right, right. The benefit amount, the benefit amount, right. That's exactly right. When you're lowering your discount rate, you're not just assuming you're going to earn less, but you're discounting less.
Right.
Obviously, I mean, you're discounting it, you know, 7.5%. It's going to be a lower present value than if you discount 6.5.
But is it? But the benefit is essentially worth more because the interest rate
I mean,
is
the
lower.
Benefit is worth what it's worth. I mean, $3,500 a month or whatever is the same whether your discount rate's 5% or 8%. It's just that you're trying to put in more money to account for that benefit payment stream. It does. That's what I get a little in trouble sometimes. I'll say, well, you know, the assumptions don't really impact the cost of the plan. That's technically true, but it impacts what gets contributed when you're contributing the ADEC.
Right.
Because you're assuming, exactly like you said, you're assuming you're going to earn less, so you have to pay more to take the same amount of benefit. I mean, the benefit's worth what it is. If you're assuming less money is going to be earned toward it, then you've got to pay more to make up the difference. I don't know if that was helpful or not. I got lost on the answer.
It's fine.
All right.
Thank you.
I'm going to move.
I was just going to add here.
I'll jump all over the place there. Please.
I think your last bullet here is important to point out that, you know, that 17.29, that's the total active population. Obviously, the group that was hired post-March 2011, that's in kind of the least generous tier of benefits. Their normal cost is around 15.7% of pay. So there is, and as that group becomes the majority in the plan population, you know, we do expect this as a percent, the normal cost as a percent of pay to come down some.
Right. You know, barring any other assumption changes. So asset smoothing, I know we've talked about this plenty. I won't spend too much time on this unless you want to. Obviously, the market value of assets, what you see on your balance sheet, your income statement, the actuarial value of assets is used to smooth out gains and losses over a five-year, well, in your case, a five-year period of time. PMRS using 10 years, not my own. Anyways, five-year period of time. And the idea really is you're trying to mitigate the market volatility impact on your funded percentage and your actual determined contribution. Again, you're not paying actual determined contribution, not you, the city's not paying actual determined contribution. I know Kelly and I have had discussions in the past. Do we really need the actuarial value of assets? Do you need it? No. Technically, you do not need it. It is a little unusual for a multi-billion dollar system not to use it to smooth out gains and losses. If for no other reason, you know, you're kind of comparing yourself with others. Now, comparing yourself with others is not really an important item right now, but it kind of puts you on a speaking the same language with other plans. If you change the market value of assets and say, look, we just don't want, then that's fine. It's not going to change anything unless the city starts contributing the ADIP. But it would be a little unusual not to have it, but that's...
And you report both numbers.
Yes, both numbers. The fund percentage is included on both numbers in the report. But, going back is, when plans who do contribute the ADEC, cities contribute, when you have a bad, 20, yeah, the years are blending together, was it 18, 19, December took a big hit, 17, one of those years, 19, everything was going along okay, and then boom, at the end of the year, and that's the whole reason. The valuation is a snapshot of one day in time, and you're really at the whims of whatever the asset value is December 31. If you're contributing without asset smoothing, contributing the ADEC, you have a bad week after Christmas or a bad month, and all of a sudden your contribution spiked up. So that's the reason behind smoothing. The funded percentage, it is what it is. Right now, the 21 valuation, actuarial value is 41.59, market value is 37.99. You're still unwinding yourself out of some of your asset allocations or asset allocations, but your investments you're trying to work your way out of, so you haven't been able to capture the market gains the last couple of years, which stinks, but it is what it is. I mean, you've got to deal with it. As we mentioned in the past, the fund percentage is projected to continue to decline. And I hate beating that drum every time, but it's worth beating just to make sure everybody knows it's going to be it's going to get worse before it gets better. And you guys know that, and it is projected to get better, but it's going to be a while. It's still a ways out. So I just want to make sure no one's ever surprised by this. And I'm going to keep saying it every time just because it needs to be said. We don't like saying it either, but this changes every year, obviously based on primarily your asset performance.
But I think, I am a huge believer in a dashboard that tells you about forward-looking things that when you talk about where you get in trouble, the two big areas are sort of liquidity and then solvency. And you can have solvency and liquidity tend, in the short term, solvency and liquidity tend to be more or less the same thing. Then you have a long-term solvency issue. Would you agree that when you look at these numbers and you look at the changes that were made in 2017, we had at that point a liquidity problem, and the legislation dealt with that, and then some of the decisions we've made as a body have dealt with that. And then structurally, we have a medium to longer term solvency issue, but not a short term solvency issue. And so as we deliberate as a body and we talk about potentially some external funding down the road, those are all things that then could solve that medium to longer term problem. Would you, from an actuarial standpoint, as a business person, sort of agree with that as sort of framing where we are right now?
Yes, I agree. And of course, as a reminder, that the main issue with the liquidity in 2016 was the run of the bank on the drops, and you paid out $825 million in benefit payments that year. That's when usually would have been closer to 280. 275 at the time, and then that was massive.
But the
steps have been taken, I think. I agree with
the gears that all interconnected is, like, for instance, putting in place the safety reserve. That was to help, deal with any potential liquidity issue.
Right.
The plan changes were the biggest issue in terms of liquidity issue. But now we're taking money out of the safety reserve, putting it into the longer-term allocation that hopefully generates a higher rate of return, which then allows us in the position to either achieve or exceed the 6.75, which then in turn, over time, will hopefully allow us to reduce the amount of the unfunded liability.
Right.
Those are all the gears that are interconnected, working together, and have to be done in a cohesive way.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay.
payroll, you know, you guys are in a different situation than most here. So obviously any plan that's statutory, percentage of pay is management payroll, but with the hiring plan, there's a lot of different moving pieces here. You know, if the year of full funding is projected to be currently 2084, this is last year it was 2075. This will change every year. It'll go forward some years, it'll go back some years. Now, obviously, a projection out to 2084, I mean, come on, it's, you know, it's we provide it because we need to provide it. You know, you've got a 63-year period projected to full funding, but a lot will happen between now and then. So the city's hiring plan, you know, their average payroll growth, the plan they put together is 3.09%. The current assumption is 2.5%. Now, there was a big jump in payroll from last year to this year, but that was part of the two-step rate raises that members got over a two-different year period. I expect next year will be more of a kind of normal increase. So if the current valuation payroll, and when we do the valuation payroll per year, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's, we like the 2021 valuation payroll is the 2020 actual payroll with a year projected based on the salary projection of that person, like where they are in the salary scale. We add a projected year increase on that. That's how we have it. Right.
And for anybody who maybe was hired during 2020, we'll annualize that salary
right.
to account for
right.
a partial year.
So, but if we took the current valuation payroll and projected about 2.5%, then it's projected to be 66% funded by 2084. There's a lot of moving parts here. Obviously, we have a floor on contributions for another couple of years, but beginning in 2025, contributions are just 34.5%. Not just, that's a good percentage, but I'm just saying, when there's no floor on the contributions and it's 34.5%, payroll is going to matter. Now, the current valuation payroll is actually a good bit over the hiring plan. Last year was the first time it was just a little bit over it. I think it was less than a million or over it. This year it went over a good chunk. But again, that was the, you know, you got those two-step rate increases, which is a big part of that. But for the five-year period, 17 through 21 inclusive, the valuation payroll is cumulatively $32 million less than the hiring plan. So increases need to average almost 3% through 2037 to meet the city's, you know, payroll projections. And that matters a great deal because you can see at the bottom, if the payroll beginning in 2025 after the floor ends through 2037 increases by the assumption of 2.5% per year, then it'd be $379 million less than we projected on their hiring plan. That comes out to $182 million less in total contributions, that's employer and employee. So, you know, that's a lot of money. $182 million, this plan needs that $182 million. So hopefully the payroll will continue at a rate that the city has projected their hiring plan. Actuarial determined contributions, like I mentioned, the employer normal cost portion plus amortization on the unfunded. It says it requires a minimum 30-year period. I think it actually probably is a maximum 30-year period. You can't even have to go greater than 30 years. Worded that incorrectly. Well, I guess it depends how you're. Anyway, you've got a funding policy in place that the 2020 unfunded liability was amortized over a closed 25-year period. And then beginning this year, each future year's gains and losses be amortized over a 20-year period, and we'll include the actual determined contribution in the report. We'll show the information how we get that. You have an effective amortization period of 24 years based on the funding policy. As we just saw a couple slides ago, your realistic amortization period right now is 63 years. If the city is contributing the ADEC, then you would be close to full funded in 25 years. And I say close because you've got the 2020 amortization. 2020 unfunded liability will be paid off, but each year there's gains and losses that will go up and down. But
question.
Yes.
What's the with the city if the city were to contribute the ADC on a current, what's the present value of that number?
You may ask, let me see here. What is the ADC?
I think
it is 200, just a little over 221 million for 2021.
Okay.
And contributions in 2020 were, what, 177 million?
Yeah, so that's the ADIC for 2021 is about almost 52% of computation pay.
Yeah.
That compares to.
Yeah, so yeah, 52% of pay compared to 34.5%. Well, this is, right now it's set what contributions are, but so the. Obviously, it would be a big increase for the city if they started paying the ADC. But you know, it depends when they want to pay this thing off. I mean, that's really what it boils down to, what they're willing to pay, what they're willing to pay. Is it okay to have the full funding projected to be 2084, or do we want it in 2040s? I can't speak to that. I can just give you the numbers. But
so just to remind,
it's a big difference.
Remind you on the funding policy, we changed it last year because we were required to by the PRB. Our current,
right.
Our existing funding policy didn't meet the guidelines, and the board sets the policy, the funding policy, not the city. My assumption is that in 2024 or 2025, when we have to go through that process to with the actuary and basically true up the fund, my assumption is there'll probably be some conversation between the board and the city on what should that funding policy be within the guidelines of the PRB. So I'd expect to see that change.
Yeah, I think we see a natural inflection point that is, maybe 2 years out, give or take, a year earlier or a year later, where I know in the original 2017 legislation there was a seven-year period, so that'll get us through 2024, and it would be hard to believe we wouldn't be outside those guidelines and that were established. And so I think, doesn't the legislation say you have to have a plan to somehow fix it? Yeah. So a lot of what we've done with this communication plan that we've worked on before that we'll be out with soon, and just, us becoming sort of informed and cohesive as a board, and then starting and increasing our dialogue with the city and other key constituencies, we're at an inflection point, and if it happens sooner, it could happen a little later, but I don't see status quo, working beyond a couple years just because of the things that Jeff's talking about.
And, I mean, because the city's not currently contributing your ADC, it is almost like a notational type number, and it's, given the way the funding policy works with that initial liability last year, getting scaled down every year. Each year that the city doesn't contribute at that level, your ADC is just going to grow because it's trying to make up for the gap in the prior year. So.
And where it may end up mattering, it could matter, is your GASB disclosure. Because the GASB disclosure, we have to show what the actual determined contribution is and what the contributions are in relation to that. And each year it's showing that, the contributions are going to be less and less percentage of the actual determined contribution. Now, that only matters, I guess, if someone cares about it, but people who may care about it are, Fitch, Moody's, S&P.
They wrote about it in their rating report,
right,
that they put out 2 weeks ago on the city.
There you go. I wasn't aware of that, but I'm not surprised.
It was 84%.
And it's going to keep dropping.
I think it's projected to be about 75% for 2021. And it's, I would say, if you don't make up that gap the way that the funding policy is now, it's just going to progressively get worse.
Right. And if nothing else, that may spur movement toward paying the ADC. I can't speak for, obviously, the city or anybody, but if it impacts their ability to borrow money and financing that needs financing, then that could, it's a catch-22. I mean, you need more money to put in the ADC to contribute, but if you had the money, you'd be, I don't know. It's but that could have an impact, real-world impact.
Well, I think from our standpoint, the ability to retain and recruit people in public safety is you know, the first, right, the first and foremost issue.
Yeah, of course.
You know, what you're talking about is very important, but, you know, people live in this city and they want and expect public safety, and we're an important part of that,
right.
And we can see a problem that your data is showing us that is medium term to long term, and it would be good for us to do something about it as much as we can while we can. And it's growing every year, and you're giving us more tools in our toolkit of educating us to understand really what we're dealing with.
Yeah, I think we've just got a couple more pages here. So plan changes. Plan changes alone save the system. No, they just cannot. You've made substantial plan changes already. They were a positive toward helping the long-term projections. But you plan changes aren't going to get you out of this. They just won't. They can't. I mean, the pensioner and beneficiary liability, two-thirds of the total liability. $3.5 billion out of $5.1 billion is to folks who are getting paid. What changes can you make? You know, you've already, the COLA and drops already changed. The active liability is 31%. So there would have to be severe cutbacks to what's already been accrued for plan changes to have an impact, and you know, obviously we won't see that happening. So you know, the employees are paying, that last bullet there, total normal costs, we already mentioned, 17.29%. Employees are paying 13.5% of that. I mean, the employees are, I don't want to editorialize, but I think employees are paying, you know, definitely their fair share. But it's not the current annual costs that are hurting you, obviously. It's the unfunded liability, how to work back things that happened in the past. That's where we are. So this brings us to what will get us where we want to be. You know, a lot of money and a lot of time. And that's what it boils down to. You can't assumption change your way out of this. You can't plan change benefits your way out of this.
It's really money or time, right? If we put a lot of money in, put $3 billion in, we don't need the time.
Yes.
Right, yeah. I mean, if you put in three, you guys get a $3 billion windfall, then hey, you're in great shape. But, you know, I'll put the money tree on there.
Well, we're really not going to get a
$3 billion. No, you're not.
No.
That's what I'm saying. Really, it's either a lot of money or you know, consistent streams of money over a long period of time. That's what the last bullet says. If it wasn't, you would see that. But that's what it boils down to. And you guys know that. I mean, I'm not telling you what you don't know already. It's just a lot of money over a lot of time. That's what it's going to take to get you where you want to be. It's just, there's no quick, easy fix on this. There's just not. I wish there was. Make your lives easier, make our jobs easier, but it's just not where we're at. So that was actually the last page we were going to go over anyways. So if there's not any questions on that, then I'm going to turn it over to Caitlin, who is going to, when this comes back up, go through the evaluation results.
Before okay, Caitlin, yeah, we need to do a little procedural.
Oh, I'm sorry. For that. I'm sorry.
But no, but you're right. She'll be up once we do this other little part.
So we're going to recess the regular meeting now, now go to required public meeting. And then with that meeting reconvened, then I think we want to turn it over to Caitlin to give us a report on our health and performance of the system with the January 2021 valuation.
And this can be found in a lot of places.
It's right after that page.
Right, it's right after that in the other section.
134, 135.
Mm-hmm.
think you're there. Can you make it bigger?
Yeah.
134.
This is the full report. Oh, you want the presentation, not the full report, which is
133.
I think we're going to stick in the regular meeting then.
No, I think the presentation goes with the valuation report, so I think it's fine.
One above the report.
Yeah, the actuarial valuation presentation.
So it is in.
There you go.
Perfect. Page 3. Yes, and.
Okay. So 133 on the PDF and diligence. Is the presentation following that as the actual report for your light reading?
Good? Okay. So, I mean, some of this is really just going to be an extension of a lot of what we just talked about. I'm going to try not to be too repetitive because we did hit on some of the results there. As Jeff mentioned, you know, this is January 1, 2021. Valuation is always going to be a snapshot. Data as of that date, assets as of that date. You know, assumptions we've changed as of that date. So just to, you know, make that point that this is all as of the beginning of the year, it doesn't reflect anything that may have happened since that point. First thing we're going to talk about is the actuarial determined contribution, which is obviously something we just spent a lot of time on. A lot of what we just said is here. Obviously, last year was the change in the funding policy, you know, going from that 30-year open period to close 25-year period. It means the chunk of your liability now is being written down over a 25-year period from January 1, 2020. That the majority of that will be, and hypothetically would be paid off at this ABC level. Any gains and losses since then, that means this year the investment loss, I think there was a slight experience loss, but there's also a contribution loss that goes into this, you know, meaning the extent to which the city's contributions don't exceed the ADC, that's going to get re-amortized each year, and then also any assumption changes. Obviously, the biggest this year being lowering the discount rate from 7 to 6.5%. All of those each year will get amortized over a 20-year period and hypothetically paid off in a 20-year period. So because we're only 1 year into this, the effective amortization period for your ADC is about 24 years now. Jeff had mentioned this. So the 2021 ADC is about $221.3 million. I think I had mentioned it's about 52% of your computation pay. That number is just going to go up as the city doesn't contribute at the ADC level, just being the nature similar to, you know, if you are making payments on a loan and you consistently don't make the payments you're supposed to make, you're going to have to make catch-up payments, and that's kind of what the ADC is going to turn into as we kind of work our way through this. This policy. For 2020, actual contributions were about $162 million, and that was about 87% of the ADC last year. They were expected to be right around that level. That's the $5.72 million for 26 pay periods, plus the $13 million that's the statutory level agreed to back in 2017. Looking forward for 2020, that goes up to $5.88 million for the 26 pay periods, plus $13 million. The city's contributions are going up each year based on those statutory guidelines put together. But I think I had mentioned this too, that we're projecting that at that level, that'll be about 75% of the ADC.
I just have a question. What has to happen on the city side to either meet or exceed the ADC plan payment?
The willingness to pay it. I mean,
so,
it's about $60 million a year. We're putting in $165 million roughly, and according to your numbers, you'd have to get up to...
No, I mean, I know what the amount... the question is it their unwillingness to pay, their inability to pay the required amount?
So in 2017, when we... passed the legislation, the statute now requires the contribution that the city's putting in. And right now, that's what they're paying is what's required in the statute. There is no legislative approval that has to happen for them to contribute more, but right now they're choosing to contribute what the statute requires and not anything in addition to that.
Gotcha. All right.
That's, again, I'm trying to editorialize too much. As an actuary, that's why a lot of actuaries don't like statutory rates, because with the time they're put into place, often not in this situation, but a lot of times when they're put into place, they meet the needs of the plan. But over time, things change, and they don't always meet the needs. You know, assumptions change, they get strengthened, plan benefits may change. And when someone's, not just Dallas, but if the city or state is contributing, say, well, we're paying, and we see this many times, we're paying what we're supposed to pay. Well, you're paying what you're required to pay, what the minimum amount you're required to pay, but what you should pay, based on the report, is at this level. So paying the statutory rate, they're meeting their obligations legally, but that doesn't mean they're paying what needs to be paid to the fund. And I'm not trying to cut on Dallas, because that we see that any place that has a statutory rate, that happens.
Going to get locked into the statutory rates. It doesn't react to what has actually changed since 2017.
Right.
I will say, I mean, the funding policy does have a line that if the city contributes, I think it's outside of 2% of the ADC for 2 years in a row, the board can recommend a change. That will almost certainly be triggered at the end of this year. 2020, it was obviously not within 2%. It's 2021. Short some miracle that happens in December. It will also be far below, 98% of ABC. So. Funding ratios. So on the actual basis, this decreased, about 45.7% to 41.6. A lot of that is due to the kind of jumping ahead here on this page, the market return and the actual return were well below the assumed 7% rate, negative 0.5% for on the market basis, which, obviously, given the way you've been writing down your assets, you kind of didn't get that fourth quarter rally that other plans may have seen in 2020. The actuarial return is a little greater because obviously we're smoothing those investment losses over the five-year period. So that'll slowly be reflected. To the extent that your investment returns don't exceed the assumed rate, we'll expect the actuarial return to be below as those deferred losses work their way through. Market basis, you're down to about 38% funded. Jumping around this page a bit. The deferred investment losses is about $184 million. Just keeping that in mind, that's the difference between the $2.12 billion in the ABA and the $1.94 billion in the market value.
So even if you hit your 6.5% return the next few years, you'd still have losses on the actuarial side because you've got to bring those future losses in.
Assumption changes, obviously the net investment return assumption came down to 6.5%. That was agreed on a couple months ago. We look at the ad hoc COLA timing every year. That is expected to kick in once the plan reaches 70% funded. So that changed. So that's something we look at every year after we get your assets and kind of preliminary liabilities done. We look at the cash flow projection, look at when you're expected to hit 70% and update that. So that was 2063 last year, 2069 this year. That's something we'd look at and change every year. Just more on the ADC, the reconciliation, kind of moving through where you were last year and how you got to the number this year. You're at that $185 million last year for the ADC. Prior to any changes in the amortization or the assumption change mentioned, that went up to about $201 million for 2021, and that is due to the investment loss and then also, obviously, what we kind of call a contribution loss, and that just means, as we mentioned, the extent that the actual contributions fall short of the prior year ADC that goes in there. After you reflected the change in the amortization and of recognizing those gains and losses over a 20-year period rather than the 24 period on the total liability, goes about $203 million there, and then after you reflect the discount rate change, obviously that was a big driver here. That's what bumps it up to $221 million for the year.
And one small note I should make, not that it's really important to the overall, that top line where it says it dropped to 22 years, the effective amortization period, that should say 24, so sorry about that.
Page here is where we have all of your numbers for you. Kind of hit on a few pieces here. That total normal cost, we talked about as, you know, that we've been referring to it as a percentage of pay. Look at it here. This is what it actually works out to dollars basis. I mean, about $60.9 million last year, up to $73.9 million this year.
No, the total normal cost in the 2020 column as a percentage of pay is not 17.4. That should be 15.3. I'm sorry, I don't know what happened there. But anyways, I'm sorry about that. I just needed to point that out.
So the total normal cost increased about 20%, which is a lot. A lot of that was due to the salary increases. Jumping ahead, your computation pay for the year was up about 8% over the prior year. Given this is a salary-based plan, if you see a big jump in salary increases, you're going to see a corresponding jump in the normal cost. So that was about 8% of the increase. The other 13% was for the lower discount rate change, particularly for, you know, when you change your when you lower your discount rate, liabilities as a whole go up, but it's kind of a duration-based thing. Obviously, pensioners have a much shorter duration of benefit payments that are getting discounted, so usually the impact of a discount rate change on them is lesser than an active participant. And the normal cost, where we're looking at a much longer duration, you know, a participant's entire career at some point that they just started. So that anytime we change the discount rate, it always has the largest impact on your normal costs. And so that attributed about 13% of the increase there.
One of the questions I had is we're paying off about $24 million a month of liabilities. Do we know what we're accruing each month for new liabilities for service earned?
We don't really look at that as a monthly basis.
Or an annual number.
Well, really, the annual number would be the 73 point. Okay. I don't know if this gets posted, this presentation, online, but I'm going to send you a clean version on Monday.
Okay.
So it's somewhere around $74 million?
Yeah, $74 million. Well, that's
the cost.
That's the cost, yeah. As far as you're talking about the...
How much additional liability are we adding every year?
Well, I can tell you your liability, prior to any assumption changes, your liability from last year to this year in total went up, well, it's right there on the page. It went up, well, prior to the assumption changes, it went up $133 million. After the assumption changes, it went up another $200
million. That's after taking into account paying off liabilities.
Right.
That's a net number.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so pay, I mean, I think being a pay-based plan, you know, the city has worked in those double-step increases over the past couple years. So I think we saw pretty high salary increases this year, and they continued this year. Last year and this year, as they work their way through this, we expect that to stabilize a little bit. 8% is much higher than we're used to saying. And jumping ahead a little bit, but the active population actually went down slightly. So you had a big increase in pay, and the population stayed level. So that really was just, you know, average pay across the board went up from 2020 in one. I did have the funded ratio before your assumption changes was about 44%. After you reflect that discount rate change, that's what drops you down about 41.6%. So, I mean, that is playing a role here. Jeff mentioned, though, I mean, that purely is our assumption of, you know, what the true cost is going to be, what actually happens to the extent that investment returns exceed 6.5. Obviously, that is just good news, but being down at that lower level helps protect you a little bit from when assets don't exceed 6.5, which has been the case the past few years. The rest of the stuff here has been touched on. Trying not to repeat too much. Here's just a summary of the data, you know, from last year to this year. As I mentioned, your active population was down just very slightly. More importantly, that drop, the number of participants, active participants who are in the drop is down significantly, but we've seen the past few years since those plan changes were made. We don't currently assume anybody is going to be taking the drop, so...
We don't assume new members are... We don't assume few are going to enter the drop.
Yeah, enter the drop, yeah.
There may be a couple here and there, but that's going to be an anomaly compared to everybody else at this point.
I think what we've seen, the people who do, it's just a handful of people who have maybe maxed out at the 90%, so they kind of see they can't hurt, even if it's not the maybe great, generous benefit it once was. It, once you're at that 90% cap on accrual, it does make sense. Retirees and beneficiaries just up just slightly. We did see some retirements. I will say the fund had I hate to refer to it as a mortality gain, but there just seems to be an uptick in mortality during 2020, whether COVID played a role or not. Obviously, some of that could continue into 2021. The history of your asset returns over the past, I think, 12, 13 years. Obviously, you can see in 2014, 2015, pretty low returns there, and that's just as you were significant write-downs in your plant in the assets as you were kind of tying yourself out of some of the old investments there. 2016 is the point when we kind of reset the asset method and started smoothing. You can see since then, you know, part of the reason we do smooth assets is it does give you a much more stable look at things. You'll see that the darker blue is your actual rate of return. From 2016 and 2020, it has stayed a lot more level compared to your market rate, which has obviously jumped up and down during that same time. Looks like at your assets compared to the actual accrued liability over that same, actually this is just the 10-year period. Obviously the thing that jumps off the page is the dip from 2016 to 2017. Those are obviously when all the plan changes went into effect. You kind of saw the similar asset dip at that time just due to writing down some assets, and I think that was also the same time that you made a large chunk of drop payment.
Yeah.
All that kind of working together. So obviously 2019 and 2020, we saw a slight increase in the liability, and that was we had a discount rate change then up from 7.25 to 7, going now from 2020 to 2021. You have another decrease in the discount rate, which increases liabilities again, this time from 7 to 6.5. So over that 2-year period, you did go from 4.5 billion in liability to 5.1, but you also lowered your discount rate 75 basis points over the same time period. This is just also looking at funding percentage over the last 10 years. This kind of mirrors that graph before. You see the dip there from 2015 to 2016 as you wrote down assets and you had the big chunk of drop payments that went out. It's definitely been more stable since then, although still declining. And I think as Jeff has mentioned, we definitely expect it to continue to go down over the short term. So risk, we've talked a lot about payroll and contribution risk, and that's kind of where the presentation ends. But investment risk, too, obviously lowering the long-term assumed rate of return has helped just because it is giving you a lower target. And to the extent that investment returns exceed that, that's kind of only gravy. You see here for 2020, your benefits and administrative expenses exceeded contributions by about $105 million, about 5% of your market value of assets. So short of 5% investment return, your assets are going to go down. So that's kind of the connection there. You're very reliant on investment income right now to pay the benefits that you owe. We're still projecting kind of lower than 6.5% over the next few years of your expected rate of return as some of the assets are still kind of unwound. Ideally, though, within the next 5 to 10 years is when we'll be taking more of that longer-term look, and hopefully you're hitting that 6.5% mark. But obviously, cash going out of the plan, about 5% of your assets, means that if you don't get a 5% investment return, you're going to be losing money in the short term at least. Longevity and demographic risk, obviously we review all your assumptions every year, but last year we also did the bigger experience study, so this is, I mentioned mortality gain, but obviously there's also risk that participants live longer than expected. It means you'll be paying out more in benefits than we're projecting. There's some risk there.
on the other side, you know, if people die sooner than we expected, you're paying out less in benefits. So there's slight gain. Same on turnover and retirement patterns. You know, we do our best to try and predict, but to the extent experience varies from our assumptions, there is some risk there. Contribution risk, you kind of jump forward for that.
We touched on a lot of this in payroll, so we'll go ahead and wrap it up. And I know we've got other stuff on the agenda, but this is a little bit more detail about the difference between the hiring plan and payroll, the projected value evaluation payroll. But you know, we really hit the highlights of what we wanted to put forth. If there aren't any questions, we'll go ahead and wrap it up.
Can I just add? I'd just like to bring your attention to kind of the lines that start with 2027. So we focus a lot every month in the contribution report, and we're comparing the floor, the hiring plan, and the current pay. And the city has done a really great job of getting really high raises, as Caitlin talked about, up to this point. And I kind of focus in my own mind about that 2024-2025 time frame. But we need to really, for all of this to work out and not have this risk of the payroll, they have to have more than 3% raises, you know, on average for all of those years out the next 30 years, because we're assuming it's only going to be 2.5%. And if they meet the hiring plan and they're over 3%, that's when we get funded in 2084. If they don't, and they're more close to the 2.5%, that's in 2084, we're only going to be 64% funded. So I just wanted to bring your attention that things look really great now. The city has to continue to do these big raises. I want to point it out, and then when I do my presentation, I won't have to belabor it. But I like that chart because you can see the big negative numbers really start there in the difference column after that point.
Yeah, they've done a lot of catch-up. You can see the 2021 numbers far exceeding our valuation payroll, but it's got to continue at that level. And it is that inflection point about 2025, which is also when they start to kick in. Right now, the 34.5% of pay.
Right. Is there anything, Jeff or Caitlin, you want to say on the supplemental plan before I do my little bridge chart presentation?
It's still there.
There is a decent increase in the population this year, about 10%. They saw a similar increase in pay. You know, I feel like a lot of it mirrored. Liability was up about 4%. Normal cost was, or the assumption changes increased liability about 4%. Normal cost was 10%. The city does actually contribute the ADC there. It had a similar funding policy change last year. I think they were on a...
Not the same period. Closed period.
Yeah. So they're, I think, on a closed 20-year period, and then gains and losses are amortized over a closed 10-year period. So they did contribute, I think, exactly that in 2020. So if that continues, ideally that sub-plan would be fully funded or close to fully funded in the next, 10 years or 20 years.
The funding rate dropped from 48.3% to 43.7%. And no surprise, the funding rate dropped.
Okay.
Guys, thanks. You can't manage what you don't measure, and so you guys are fundamental to our ability to do our job and manage it. We appreciate what you do, and I know that thanks for taking us into the sausage factory today and how it's done.
So, John, can you go to slide number 93? So, well, you're going there. This is, you'll recall the last few years I've done this bridge chart, which really just projects, takes Jeff's and Caitlin's information and puts it kind of in a different form, because we all don't think like actuaries, at least I don't, that's for sure. But 93.
Yeah.
You don't have it? Okay, there we go. Thank you. So I only have about 6 slides here, and I'm not even going to go over all of them, but this next slide, 94, I think is interesting. And what this slide does is they talked a lot about where did we come in relative to our assumed rate of return and their numbers. But what I like to look at is when they did the valuation last year, they made assumptions on what would happen in 2020. Did that happen? How close were we? Did we, how did actual
compared to really that first year projections, and that's what this slide shows. So what you can see here is, and you'll recall back in 2020 when we were giving the numbers to Siegel to run their numbers, it was basically October, early October timeframe, and we were projecting we were going to lose 6% on our investment portfolio. And then what ended up happening is we actually, instead of losing $119 million or $120 million that was projected, we lost $9 million. So we still lost money, didn't make the the rate of return assumption, but it was $110 million better than we expected it to be. So that is primarily why we, last year when they presented the valuation, if you would have looked into this year, we would have thought we would have been at $1.8 billion. We're actually at $1.94 billion. Not where we want to be, but better than we expected to be. As far as contributions go, the projection was $215 million in contributions. We actually received $219 million. Benefit payments were also a positive. It was expected to be $333 million. It was actually paid out $317 million, and admin expenses were less than was projected. So all of the trends, although not where we want to be on an actuarial basis, at least it shows that when we're doing the projections, we're starting in a good place with reality and then building on that for the next, you know, 60 years. So what happens by the time you get there? I don't know, but at least the first step is a good step. This chart is the one you're familiar with for the full year. You've seen it before. It's just beginning of the year, net assets or net position, and ending year, and the changes. So again, you can see we continue to pay out a significant amount, more than $100 million more in benefits than we're receiving in contributions, and that's a challenge we will continue to take face for a long time. This just shows the trend of our actuarial liability and the market value of assets and the funded percentage, just like they talked about earlier in a different format. This is the chart that we look at a lot. If you compare this chart to this chart you saw last year, we're in the negative period for longer, and it's deeper. That's to be expected because we lowered the discount rate. But we're still, it's the chart you've been familiar with. Net benefit payments we're going to have, even under the city's hiring plan, which is the blue line, versus the, if we don't meet the hiring plan and have the 2.5% growth factor, it's not projected that the contributions will be higher than the benefit payments until those lines kind of cross in 2061 there. So we have a lot of years of outflows before we have inflows coming in. This chart just shows you the funded percentage. The blue lines are the funded percentage from 2020 is the dashed blue line, and 2021 is the solid blue line for the funded percentage based on the hiring plan. So you can see that last year we thought we would be better. That's because we lowered the discount rate primarily because we had factored in the lower, it would have impacted the lower, the minus six, would that have impacted the funding? Or is that just a cash flow thing?
No, it would have gone in.
Okay. So that would have been factored in. So this is really primarily the discount rate. And then the orange lines are the same information, just based on hiring plan versus growth factor.
I'll say something interesting here is your dash for the payroll growth is, you know, it's actually a little better this year, even with lowering the discount rate, and that's just because of the big salary increases as well.
Right, right. So that's really just the same kind of information and presented in a different way. That's all I wanted to show you.
Can we just go back to the chart, the 95, where you show the different, yeah. I think it's good to see here, and Ryan, when he presents later, will speak to this. This is the 2020 year, so we have a negative $9 million, and what we see is that we have some percentage that we have allocated to the places we want to be invested in the long term. They've produced pretty good returns. We've had good market years, and then we have this huge drag from all these legacy assets. What we'll see when we look at 2021 is a positive number overall, but once again, we still have a drag, but the percentage of the total portfolio that's in the long-term allocation has increased because we've monetized assets out of those legacy assets, and we're getting pretty good returns in that area. If you just do the simple math, if you had the target 6.5% or 7% return of $2 billion, then you would have been positive net position for the year, and that's the way that if you're functioning in a healthy way, what you should be doing, you know, year to year with, you know, with the market fluctuations, some high, some low. That's where we're headed to. Okay, that's what we're trying to get to. And we have to deal with the problem of the gap that we have, but we've taken the steps of the things that we control to, we think, put this in a good step going forward. And that's really what Kelly's speaking to. Anything else?
No, unless there's questions.
Okay, so, so we've done that. Okay, so now what we want to do is open up for any public comment for the public meeting.
Right.
So is there anyone that has anything they want
to... press 5-star on the phone. That'll raise your hand.
Okay, if we have nothing, then what we want to do is adjourn the required public meeting. We have a motion to do that?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor? All right.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries, so the public meeting is now adjourned. Now we're going to go to the regular meeting, and what we want to do relative to that is we'd like to make a motion to approve the report that Jeff and Caitlin just delivered to us, and accept that, and to forward that to our auditors and for Kelly's final review. So we have a motion to do that.
Moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, that motion carries. Now we will go to Brenda to go over our quarterly financial reports. Can you tell us where in Diligent, what page that is?
$1.876 billion.
compared to $1.857 billion at 12/31, or an increase of almost $19 billion. The two largest components of the change were equity securities and real assets. Equity securities have increased by $155 million during 2021. In March and April of this year, the passive global equity mandate was funded with Northern Trust, and in September, the small cap mandate with Eastern Shore was funded. To fund these mandates, we used redemptions from Boston Partners and Manulife, Walter Scott, along with some additional cash. Real assets declined by $120 million this year, related primarily to distributions and sales from the investments. AEW, we received $25.4 million for the sale of the Camel Square self-storage, $9.6 million for RCH loan repayment, and just recently $43.5 million for the sale of the Christopher. Along with those distributions, we had one for the sale of Spring Valley at $15.4 million. We also sold San Pedro, which was managed by Forest Investments, received $3.1 million. And then other distributions from Clarion and J.P. Morgan Maritime. In addition to these distributions, there have also been valuation changes over the period for the first and second quarter that have affected that value. As we move down the page and we look at receivables, you have the city and member contributions receivable. And the increase from year-end is primarily related to the number of days that are accrued at the end of the month. In September, we accrued 16 days, and in December, we accrued only 9 days. So that relates to that, pardon me, that increase. As we continue down the schedule, we look at cash. Cash has decreased by $6.8 million since the year-end, and that decrease is related to cash used for rebalancing as well as to pay benefits during the year. And the last item we'll look at here is AP and other accrued liabilities. They declined by almost $1.4 million since the end of last year. We had decreases in the accrual for fund management fees and AP, as well as other liabilities and refunds payable, and then some increases in the uncompensated absences for employees. Now we're going to go to take a look at the changes in fiduciary positions. So city contributions. See that as the first item here. City contributions increase. This schedule compares 9/30/2021 to the same period last year, 9/30/2020. City contributions increased by $2.6 million year over year. That increase is due to the floor increase that you've heard, already spoken about today. It increased from $5.724 million per pay period to $5.882 million, and that total increase that related to the floor was $3.1 million. As we look at member contributions, they increased $1.1 million year over year. That's due to the salary increases that you heard Siegel talk about earlier. Regular member contributions increased by $1.7 million. However, there was a decline in drop contributions of 382 that helped to offset that. Employee headcount, as you compare September 30th of last year to this year, has declined by 65 people. As we continue down the page and we look at investment income, it increased by almost $100 million year over year. Net appreciation, depreciation increased by $102 million, and that was primarily driven by changes in equity, which was up $66 million, and real assets that were up $35 million. As we look at interest and dividends that are up $195,000, these increases are due to real assets income that was up $2.8 million and dividends that were up $965,000, but they were offset by declines in both long-term and short-term interest for the period. As we look at benefits, paid to our members, benefits paid to the members increased by $3.8 million year over year. Service pensions increased by $3 million. Survivor benefits increased by $846,000. These increases were offset by declines in disability payments of $131,000. And newer service retirement at higher monthly benefits is the primary driver in the increase in benefits paid to members. We'll finish up by looking at expenses. So we look at legal expenses. They're down about $200,000 year over year due to the resolution of some cases that occurred in 2020, as well as the timing of some expenses. Staff expenses have decreased by $184,000 year over year, and that's primarily due to the fact that we currently have three open staff positions. I'll end with a quick look at professional and administrative expenses. They've increased $36,000 when compared to the same period last year. We had increases in legislative consultants expenses due to the legislature being in session this year, along with communications and maintenance, and declines in things like actuarial expenses, employment expenses, and audit expenses. Are there any questions about the financials?
Okay, let's move on to Kelly.
Great. On page 258 of your diligent and PDF is the summary chart for the contribution report. We are on track. Nothing's changed from the last few months. This is September's numbers. There were three payrolls during this time frame. We still are at 105% of the hiring plan for contributions, 97% of the floor. That's true for the month and for the year, year to date. So there's really no news here other than they continue to do what they need to. Based on the actual hiring numbers, they're down about 180 people. And that's all employees somewhat offset by some fire that is over by about 28 firefighters. So nothing, no news here, really. Same old trend that we've seen. Are there any questions about the contribution report? Okay. On page 262 is the board approval of trustee education and travel for your information. I don't believe there's any requests for travel on this one, but there's classes, so we don't need a motion unless somebody wants to add their name to any of these classes.
Okay.
Can I go on to the next item?
Sure.
Number 10?
Yes.
Okay. And many of you will recall that once a year I have to provide the board, I being the executive director, have to provide the board a training manual. This is one of the things that is in the statute, and the way we do that is it's always available for you electronically. This is, I'm sorry, I forgot to say, it is page 265 of your packet, and I just have the discussion sheet in the material. So instead of giving you a hard copy of this training manual, it's always available to you in the Resource Center on Diligent. What is included in this training manual is also dictated by the statute. John, will you pull up the screenshot?
cost, instead of taking the time to pull up Diligent here, because he's on Zoom, we thought we'd just show you some screenshots. So if you get into Diligent on your laptop computer, not your iPad or your phone, the where the training manual is in where John has it circled there, it's the resource center. That's what it looks like here. It's kind of in that upper corner. If you're pulling it up on your laptop, I mean on your iPad or your phone, there's a bar over on the left side where you can find the resource center. Once you click on the resource center, there's all kinds of information here. The second one is the training manual. You'll also see before we click off of this, there's all kinds of information that you might find interesting. There's board presentations, and those presentations are separated by, if you want to relive the Siegel presentation from last year, it's there. You can find all the Siegel presentations together, all the Makeda presentations together, all of, you know, various ones, so you don't have to try to remember what meeting they were at. All of that information's there. But in the training manual specifically, if you go to the next page, John, you'll see the different chapters. So there are 8 or 9 chapters here. All of this information is required by the statute for us to give to you. The first item is really just the statute. So we have the statute. We also have the plan document for the supplemental plan here. We have the budget under the next item. The next item has to do with basically laws that apply to the board. That's really what most of the rest of this is, laws that apply to the board and a variety of different things. So there's the open meetings law, open records laws, there's the government code, different things that we've determined are things that impact the board. In other chapters, you'll see the code of ethics and the governance policy. And the very last one is, again, all these are required to be given to you, is training from Makeda, and it's on alternative investments. So there's a presentation on alternative investments that Makeda did that's there for you. It's all there for you. If you ever have any questions about anything, we do update it when the legislature changes or something changes. Let me know if there's questions. What I do need from you before you leave today is you need to sign off that you were delivered this, that you received the training manual. And so you should have those. The people that don't have them will email them to you, but you can leave those with Melissa on your, or leave them at your place. That would be great. Any questions on the training manual? And if this isn't an effective way to deliver it to you, we're happy to do it another way.
Okay. Thanks, Kelly. Ryan, portfolio positivity update.
Okay, positive portfolio update coming up. Thanks, Nick. I'm going to start with the portfolio update. We got a short investment agenda, then we'll move into a review of the private equity and debt portfolio. Start with the private markets. Summary there, we're up to $157 million in distributions coming out of the private markets portfolio year to date. With that, along with the reduction in the safe reserve with the new asset allocation, we've been able to redeploy $123 million back into the growth portfolio, public portfolio with global equity, EM equity, and EM debt. We're expecting about another $40 million of rebalancing to occur by year end to get to the new lower target with the safety reserve. And then on the new manager search front, we received RFPs 2 weeks ago for the international small cap search. We have finalist interviews over the next few weeks and expect to bring a few firms in to meet with the IAC in December. All right, moving ahead to 269. This is the year-to-date simplest way to look at estimated investment return. We're at 4.1%. We're starting with the beginning of year, end of last year investment number from Makeda, which was $1.996 billion. We've paid out a net $87 million in benefit outflows. We've received $80 million year-to-date in investment income gain, so that puts our current NAV at $1.988 billion. So if we focus in now just on the public portfolio on the next page, which is 68% of the portfolio, including cash, that would be 72%. As Nick said, that's up from 64% at the beginning of the year. The public portfolio is up almost 10% year-to-date, 9.5, compared to a benchmark of the 60-40 benchmark of 8%. You can see the equity portfolio is up considerably, and then the fixed income portfolio is flat year to date.
But, Brian, would it be fair to say that of our 4.1% year to date, the public portfolio is a 9.5% return,
mm-hmm.
that our long-term allocation is 85%, right?
85%.
Long. Yeah, and 15% in healthy private investments, and we have a combination of healthy and unhealthy investments. So when we think about the 2084 and the ADAP and all those actuarial things that went over before, when we look at just the change in the position year to year, that here, you know, we're getting strong returns out of the portfolio that we want for the long term,
mm-hmm.
and this is why we're heading in this direction. This is why we're doing what we do, and to me, this is really good news within other broader headlines, some of which are troubling, some of which are middle of the road, and so on, but I just think it's important for us to see this is the direction that we're headed in, and we have good evidence here of 9.5% return. You know, 9.5 times, you know, $2 billion of assets is, you know, we're 170, 180 million of investment return, and we have a hurdle rate of 6.5, and you know, this portion of the portfolio exceeds that, and so we just want to make sure everyone is tracking, you know, what the numbers are and why we're headed in that direction.
Thank you. So just briefly, asset allocation, we're currently at 27.4% in private markets, going down to the target of 15. So we have another $250 million to go to get to that 15% target. This shows that we did a $33 million rebalancing at end of the month, beginning of November. So we added $12 million into global equity to rebalance the four active managers. We added $9 million to emerging market equity, which gets us right up to that 5% long-term target there, and then $12 million into EM debt, which brings that up pretty close to target and in line with the rest of the fixed income managers. So, as I said, I expect to do one more rebalancing action before the end of the year to get us to that new target for the safety reserve. So this is just looking at the asset allocation bar chart. In a minute, Greg's going to talk about two sleeves here, the private equity at 6.7% and the private debt portfolio, which is just two investments remaining at 0.4% of the portfolio. Before I hand it over to Greg, I just wanted to announce that we have hired a new member to the investment team for the investment officer position. His name's Akshay Patel. He's coming down from the Illinois State University Retirement System. He has 3 years of experience there. He's going to be starting in mid-December. So you guys will probably meet him at the January board meeting. Any questions on the portfolio at large before I hand it over to Greg? There you go.
We're on page 276 in the PDF in Diligent. So we're going to review the private equity and private debt. What the idea of this is to get you kind of a high-level idea of who the managers are, what's remaining in the portfolio. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about energy and Lone Star Investment Advisors, so we're going to spend our time today kind of talking about the remainder of the private equity and private debt portfolio. So the total portfolio combined is about $140 million. And to kind of put that in perspective, we think our private assets is about 27% of the total plan. This private equity and private debt combined ended up being about 7%. Of that, Lone Star and Huff Energy is about 5%. So we're really talking about the remaining 2% of total EPFP assets. Just to give you an idea, at the bottom of the page, a reminder of where we are versus our target allocations. Private equity, we're at 6.7% versus our long-term target of 5. Private debt, we're at 0.4 versus our target of 0. We're at unfunded commitments of about $1.33 million,
and those are really from our two active funds, which is Riverstone Credit Partners and Industry Ventures Partnership Holdings 4. There's a lot of numbers and a lot of data on this page, most of which is just so that you can have it all in one consolidated place. The kind of the big takeaways of this is, you know, a lot of these funds are in liquidation, various stages of wind down. Our two active funds are vintage year 2016, and that's Industry Ventures 4 and Riverstone Credit Partners. So in hindsight, we probably should have talked about the active funds and the good news first, but I'll put it in the reverse order. So it may sound a little repetitive at times with funds being in liquidation. Huff Alternative is the first one. This fund is in liquidation. The only remaining asset in this is basically a property in Las Vegas, on the Las Vegas Strip. The fund holds a minority interest, and that property is being marketed. The valuation at this point is about $13 million, which is our next largest exposure behind Huff Energy and Lone Star Investment Advisors. Next we'll talk about is Hudson Clean Energy. This fund is in wind down. If you look at the remaining valuation on the NAV, it's only about $1 million of exposure here, but it's now being managed by Imperial Capital as the sole investment manager at Sol GP. And there's three assets here. It's a solar power company, a wind power company, and a wireless charging company. The next fund we'll talk about is North Texas Opportunity Fund. This is managed by Lone Star Investment Advisors. Again, a smaller exposure at about $1.5 million. The only remaining asset in this fund is Dallas Yellow Cab Company. They, of course, made a strategic shift to provide business through non-emergency medical transport. Obviously, kind of with the advent of ride-sharing apps, they had to change their business strategy. They've cut a lot of costs and management hopes to have this asset putting it out to market for an exit fairly soon. But the good one is we have here is the Industry Ventures Partnership Holdings. It's an active fund. This is essentially our venture capital fund. They go about it a little bit different because it's primarily through secondary, and so they're investing in venture capital funds with secondary positions, primary fund commitments, and some co-investments. The result of that process is that we have then exposure to over 1,000 active companies in the underlying portfolio, so that helps to diversify some of that kind of binary outcome risk of venture capital. The fund has been performing well with regards to valuations and exits, but it's still early in the fund term, with the fund term being 10 years. We continue to see them make distributions as they've exited some of the underlying companies and positions. So moving to the private debt, Highland Crusader, this is a fund that is in liquidation. Highland is no longer managing the fund. It's being managed by Alvarez and Marcel. They've done a good job thus far of monetizing the assets. The only thing that remains here now is investment in a healthcare company and a cash position that's really awaiting expiration of reps and warranties from prior actions. The other private debt investment is Riverstone Credit Partners. This is a fund that's set up basically to provide loans and debt to oil and gas. So we have seen the oil and gas prices recovering. They're starting to see more debt pay downs and continued coupon payments. This fund, they do expect to have a full exit by 2022. I know that was brief and quick.
Can you go back to the summary? I just want to point out two or three things. This total of 140, which is the number that bleeds into our current portfolio, in my opinion, a reasonable, potentially significant portion of it is at risk. So it's undeterminable what it is, but just given the body of facts that have happened historically,
we just want you to know that, that you know, there could be more bad news. There might not be. We have close to zero control or influence over how these assets, you know, get monetized and at what values. I think it's also always important to see that when you look at the vintage, that means that's when the decision was made. And you pay a long-term price for bad decision-making when it comes to these private investments. And this is the significant one. The latest one was 2012. So 9 years ago, up to 20 years ago, the decisions were made to deploy these significant sums of capital, and we're paying, you know, the price for that today. And we have been paying a price for it. If you look at the TBPI number, that's really the ultimate multiple of what you invested to what you realized. If you take an average of .49 and .92, it's about .7. So we're getting of a dollar invested, we've gotten 70 cents back if we monetize out of these things at the $140 million. I think the chances of that happening, there's a high degree of risk it will not happen. And I just think this is just a poster child for what bad decision making, particularly as it relates to private assets, does. You make a bad decision on a publicly traded emerging market manager, maybe you take a 5, 10, 15% hit and you move on, you get out. You make bad decisions here, you live with them a long time. I think when staff tells you about the amount of time they've spent, particularly on Lone Star and on Huff, it's a disproportionate amount of time that could have been used to other things. So just it's always good to highlight the price that gets paid for prior bad decisions, not to blame them, but just to acknowledge what it is and what the impact has been. Okay. Thanks, Greg. Okay, so now we're going, I guess I'll do an update on professional services meeting. We met last week. It's myself, Rob, Steve, and Mark. We're on the call. We were on the call with Siegel, and we just sort of reviewed the relationship, the importance that they have. They did not flag, any issues, for us. There's good communication back and forth. They're pleased with their interaction with staff, and it's just the sort of thing we routinely do. So, any other comments? Anyone else on the call?
Capture it well.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Brenda, financial audit status.
Well, with the receipt of our final outstanding financial statements last month, we were able to send the financials to the actuary. And this morning, you got to see the actuary reports from Siegel. Now that we have those reports, we will forward them on to our auditors, and we expect that our audited financials should be finished in about 30 days, and we plan to present those at the December board meeting. We are also working on the annual comprehensive financial report, and we expect to present that at the December board meeting as well. We're coming close to closure. I'll go ahead and move on to the next item, which is the second reading of the 2022 budget. We had the first reading of the budget at the October board meeting, and since that meeting, I presented the budget to the City of Dallas's Government Performance and Finance Management Committee. The committee did not have any comments or suggestions that they would like to provide to the board, to this board. We also posted the budget on our website for member review, but we have not received any comments from our members about the budget. Since the first reading of the budget, there were two changes made to the 2021 information. First, I updated the 2021 budget for the legal amendment that was approved by the board last year. So you'll see the 2021 budget is increased. I updated the 2021 projected actual for some legal fees. That was an increase of about $83,000. So those two things for 2021. For 2022, we've made one change, in the budget since it was presented last month, and that is an increase in the staff salary and benefits. Based on comments that we received at the October meeting from the board, as well as additional survey information that we received from CBIZ Public Pension Compensation, the placeholder for staff and staff payroll was increased from 2.5% to 3% for 2022. That half percent increase resulted in an increase of just under $16,000 to the 2022 budget. So to just briefly review, the total budget for 2022 is the $21.7 million, and that's the number kind of almost dead center there of what you're looking at. That's compared to $25.6 million for the 2021 budget, so that's down about $3.882 million, or 15.2%, and that's primarily related to declines in management fees and legal expenses. And when you compare the 2022 budget to the 2021 projected actual, it's down $2.4 million, or 10%. And that is driven largely by investment-related expenses. Are there any questions about the 2022 budget?
I want to confirm one thing. When we show 4.1% year-to-date as an investment return, is that net of all the attributable investment expenses that are in that are the year-to-date portion of 2021?
So, yes, that would include any investment expenses that are in there. These are both administrative expenses as well as the expenses that are showed in.
So, as a form of convention, whenever we state a return number net, that is always net of all of the expenses that are categorized as investment expenses.
I think there may be a caveat there. What about Makita and J.P. Morgan?
So they're all included in this, like this.
They're included there, but they're not.
They're not in your net.
They're not in the net investment return because those are paid directly outside of the portfolio.
Okay.
So that's $600,000.
Okay.
But everything else in that investment is the return
right.
is net.
So would it be fair to say when we see the decrease, that is just another residual side effect of going from these convoluted private assets to more public assets that tend to have lower investment expenses as a percentage of their asset total?
I mean, a lot of that's legal, but a lot of it is higher fees in privates compared to going to public that we're paying 50 bips or index.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's real.
One question is unrelated to the actual numbers, but I'd like to get information in terms of professional expenses and legal expenses as to who these parties are and their whether there are any minority or women-owned businesses involved in this.
Sure, I'll be happy to provide that information.
Do we know that with every vendor of significance?
No, we'll be able to provide the information of who we are. Some of these are public companies.
So, Mark, I want to make sure. That they get you what you want to see. So, to that end,
what I want to know is who for those expenses, who are those entities, whether any of them are minority or women-owned entities.
Okay.
I think those numbers will be very, very small, if not zero. And I have an issue. I have a concern about that.
But do you want, to the extent that we don't know, do you want Brenda to go contact them and try to find out, or?
My guess is that she won't need to be able to, won't need to go and find out whether they're.
But well, Nick, it's easy enough to ask these people if they're certified anywhere as an MBE or MWBE enterprise, and they'll all know.
And we had one woman-owned firm that we just hired for fixed income, wasn't it?
Longfellow.
Longfellow, yeah. And wasn't there another one we looked at in small cap, but we didn't hire?
There's one small cap we looked at. It's in the RFP.
So. Well, Mark said professionals.
Yeah, I mean,
you know what investment about? Yeah, I'm talking about the professional.
Not investment managers.
They're saying investment. Do you want
to? Okay. Well, let's go back to the slide. I'll tell you exactly what I'm looking at.
Okay.
The slide right before that. The professional expenses and the legal expenses.
Okay. So professional will include those numbers as well. So I'll get those for you.
Thank you.
Okay, but I guess you're saying that you were speaking to
investment.
Do you want to see that as well?
I'm okay with that right now. I don't need to see that right now. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to see it all. This is Gilbert. So I'd like to include money managers, anything, actuaries, custodians, and the like. All professional people. And again, it's an easy exercise because there aren't that many line items.
And we're focused on ownership, not who's on our accounts. Is that correct?
First, I had talked with Josh Monda before about who was on the team. But for now, I just want to know ownership. I mean, then we can maybe ask what the composition of the team, if they're majority owned. But they are. But for now, just ownership.
And just, I may be wanting to put that as something we might want to see on a more regular basis, semi-annually, annually, just to see what those look like, even though they obviously will not change very often at all. But that's not what what I'm asking for now.
Okay. Yeah, I would say let's bake it into a regular report that we want to see once we get it. We've all done a good job with that over time where, you know, so let's do that. Okay, so then I think we're in a position, Brenda, where you would staff recommendation would be you have a fully baked 2022 budget you would like to offer up to us for approval.
Correct.
Right, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so do we have a motion from someone to approve?
I'll make a motion.
Okay, second?
Second.
All in favor of approving the 2022 budget?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Good, the motion carries.
Can I just make one statement? I know it might be out of order, but I do want to congratulate staff on getting that done. I know those are not easy things to get done, particularly when you're in an asset situation like you're in. So I want to just say appreciate the work of staff.
Mark. Okay. Kelly, Executive Director's Report.
So just a couple of things. The NC for monitors. In your packet for your information, we've had two open records requests since the last board meeting. As far as the CIO recruitment, I with Brenda and Josh's assistance, we conducted the second interview round with some CIO candidates. I have a couple more I want to reach out to. And from there, my plan is to reach out to Nick and see kind of where you want to go with the pool that I have.
Okay.
So
when do you think you'd want to?
By the end of next week.
Okay, so we'd have something to collaboratively discuss with the board for the next meeting on this, you think?
That would be my hope, but I want to talk to you about the process.
Okay.
At some point, maybe you could share some of what you've got there.
Okay.
I know a lot of people in the investment community and can get reference checks for you and things like that.
Okay. That sounds great. Two other things I mentioned. Well, really, one other thing. I mentioned the signing off on the required training manual. In addition to that, if you fill out your evaluation of the Siegel training class, you can get a half hour of PRV credit to go towards your continuing education. So complete that, and then you can either hand that to Melissa on your way out. She'll give you a certificate. We'll also keep the certificate for your reporting. There's an evaluation of the actuarial for based on the PRV rules.
Okay,
you can't get credit without the evaluation form.
Okay.
And for the people on the phone, we will send those to you. That's all I had on that item.
Scott, I got a question on the website.
Uh-huh.
I noticed that a recent addition is the dates that everyone needs to look at if they're going to retire and when you get the paperwork in and when your first paycheck is. We always done that?
I don't think we have always done that. The other new thing, which reminds me, related to education that's on the website, is if you go to our website under both retirees and active, we have been posting all the education training that's been going on, not only the upcoming calendar, but also the Zoom presentations, and there's a whole bunch of classes that they've had, so a member can watch this at any time. But thank you, that reminded me of that. But that is new for the
retirees. And whoever idea that was a great idea. I think it needs to, I mean, does it get moved after a while and into maybe the members section of the web page so that they pull it up and not?
We'll make sure that happens.
I mean, it's a great information. I mean, I almost wish I had it when I did back then, but luckily I was on the board, so I knew all that. I think for someone that's out there and just saying, hey, I don't know when to retire, I don't know what to do, you go to that chart and it's right there.
Right.
Perfect.
It does help with questions from members as well as people that hadn't called us soon enough to voice those